The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
We're still in the session on formulating a market strategy. We'll sort of finish that section today and then go on to the execution of the market strategy in the marketplace. And let me just remind you, we are talking about market strategies based on disruptive technologies. And as we discussed two sessions ago, seminar two, there are sustained or incremental innovations, which are very, very important. But the style of dealing with incremental innovations and bringing them to market is somewhat different than dealing with disruptive innovation. And it's not one is better than the other. We'll talk about it at the end or the next session. You need to do both, but I really do want to focus on disruptive innovations. And, of course, we talked about somebody said, well, what the hell do you mean by a disruptive innovation? Maybe Exhibit A is the Internet and World Wide Web, and what happened when it hit the commercial markets in the mid-1990s. And, of course, our guest speaker, John Patrick, talked a lot about this. And two seminars ago, just to recap, we talked about, as we were making the decisions in IBM, whether to organize our internet strategy, we asked a number of key questions. Is the technology advanced enough? Is the marketplace ready for it? Are there other competitors out there that if we don't go out, they'll run with the market? And what are our clients saying? And the reason we embraced the internet so aggressively is because, to be honest, we didn't have a choice. I mean, we loved it also, but it would have been dumb not to do that. The stuff was absolutely taking off in the marketplace, especially after the Netscape IPO. There was this incredible excitement. There were already serious competitors out there, some established ones like Sun, others new ones like Netscape. And then our clients were starting to experiment with the internet, and we didn't want to be left out of that. So, Seth, let's go. So, these are the topics I'd like to discuss in this seminar. And the first three is based on the... Yes, please.
So, I don't know what the vision of or mission of IBM is, but as newer technologies come in, how does that change? Because you have a focus there, right?
Yes.
Based on whatever the mission is.
Yes.
How do you transform that and still keep the mission the same?
Well, first of all, you're asking a really deep question, which is no business can afford to chase every technology. So you need to make, and we'll talk about some of the things today and next time. When you see something, you need to decide, is this one that we should pursue, or is this one that is not within our core business? And we'll talk about some things, but let me give very concrete examples. For a long time, while IBM was very involved in large commercial systems, we were not involved in supercomputing, that is scientific computing systems. Part of it is antitrust things that happened in the late 60s with companies, CDC and so on, that you never heard of, and well, some of you may have heard them, but they no longer exist. And, you know, for a long time, IBM kept growing and growing and growing, ignoring the supercomputing market. Eventually, we decided that we were missing a lot of advances in large computing by not being in supercomputing, because a lot of the leading edge computing advances first showed up in supercomputing systems. And then a few years later, they percolated into commercial systems. Parallel architectures is an example. So we decided we now need to do that, but it wasn't thought out that way. And, you know, we can go through sort of that kind of reasoning with a whole set of things. But let's take the iPod. People say, oh, my God, the iPod has computing inside. You know, the iPod is a little computer. You guys are in the computer business. How come you're not in the iPod business? Well, the main reason is that the iPod is really a consumer market, not an enterprise or business market. And IBM is primarily a company that deals with institutions, you know, commercial institutions, educational, healthcare, government, but not with people as individuals. And it's a fascinating question. Well, if you guys are good, why aren't you good here and good here? Every time we try to do something here, we're really lousy at it. I mean, we just are. I mean, it's very difficult for reasons, some of which I can, you know, talk about hypothetically, and some that are mysterious, that it's very hard to be good at everything. And it gets back to culture discussions that we talked last time and we'll talk throughout, that, you know, if you have a certain culture, for example, if you have a culture of dealing with enterprises, and I'm including MIT as an enterprise, boy, if a client is unhappy, the computers aren't working, you immediately react, you send people, you fix it, because the reason the commercial clients want to do business with you is the kind of service you give them. Well, in the consumer world, if you try to behave that way, you lose your shirt. You cannot do that. So you can say, well, screw them then. In the consumer world, we don't care. But if your culture is here, you end up doing more here than you should or can afford to, and you end up not doing it well. So iPad is not our problem, not our thing. And every company, and what we're talking about is such much the essence of business strategy. And we'll get into this in right now, actually, when we talk about organizational capabilities. You have to know what you're good at. And now, can you change and be good at something different? Very carefully, and especially, if I may use sports analogies, you know, maybe if you're playing in college, you can be both in the baseball team and in the basketball team. And in fact, a lot of college athletes play multiple sports, baseball, basketball, soccer, maybe even American football. If you're playing in the major leagues, the problem is, you know, so you know, Michael Jordan, you know who Michael Jordan, you know, incredible basketball star. He decided to quit basketball and play baseball. Some of it has to do with his father. He couldn't rise above like double-A baseball. And even then, I'm sure if it wasn't because he was Michael Jordan, he wouldn't be playing in double-A even. So finally he said, screw it, and went back to basketball, and the Bulls got three more championships. When you're playing in the majors, that is, when a business is competing with world-class competition, I mean, if IBM comes out, look at Microsoft, which is such a great company, hasn't been able to take on Apple with the iPad. You know, they have the Zoom, and it's not successful. And Microsoft is much more a consumer company than IBM. So, you know, so we're just not good at that. I think these are very sophisticated reasons, and I think, and we'll talk about this now, there is nothing more important for an organization than to be soberly sensitive to what it's good at and what it's not good at. And I don't mean that you don't have a vision and where there is a will, there is a way, but, you know, I mean, it's like you almost, that's why I was talking to some of you before the class. I like to bring almost an engineering mentality to this. I remember once having dinner with a client, and after a lot of wine, he was saying, well, why can't you just build fastest unit processors, you know, instead of going SMP or parallel? And he said, well, you know, the speed of light is an issue. He said, well, but, you know, where there is a will, there is a way. And I said, I'm sorry. It's not the way it works. That you know. And you almost have to look at some of these softer limits as, can you really do it? And I'm hoping that better tools will get developed. When I say it will get developed, hopefully by people like you or companies you start or work on or whatever, so that we can even model, simulate different scenarios. So this is a very fascinating question. Please, you had a point and then I'll go.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on the point you made about IBM not being in the consumer market.
Yes.
Look how the people in the room
have. I know.
And they're no longer are there.
That's right.
And IBM pretty much invented the PC market.
Yes.
It's not there anymore. So
that's
it's
right.
It's not because of technology.
No. Almost never, and I hope this is a message that comes across from me over and over again, the limitations are almost never technology. Those are the easiest ones. Remember, IBM's PC company lost money year after year after year. So we developed gorgeous, wonderful machines. We just lost money. Well, after a while, if you keep losing money, that may be a signal that maybe somebody else should run that part of the business. And we'll talk about even alternatives to do that. So the reason for selling the PC business to Lenovo had totally to do that we were not a good consumer company because we couldn't make it a viable business. That's what it was, not because we couldn't make good thinkpads, which we did. You see, and it's a gigantic difference. Please.
You made an interesting analogy to Michael Jordan. Pretty much as far as you think about branding, I mean, the reason why he's able to penetrate the market that he didn't have a viable foundation.
You mean baseball?
Yeah. I mean, so if you look at the consumer market, the
right.
You have branding.
Yes.
You're actually allowed sometimes to penetrate the market.
Yeah.
Of that brand.
Right.
You know, so it's not because of not having a viable foundation.
Mm-hmm. No,
and penetrate results because of the brand. So
yeah.
How would you explain that versus
the lack of branding?
Yeah.
Again, as expected, you all ask extremely profound questions. Part of what you need to decide is, can you shape the marketplace to accept you in these new markets? And again, let me go back to IBM. IBM's brand for commercial customers is superb. A lot of it based on support and whatever. IBM brands, if you go outside and you see kids and you say IBM, I'm sure they've heard of IBM, but you know, the brand as an iPad kind of thing is almost non-existent. Now, then you can ask a very good question, which is, couldn't you spend a ton of money and evolve your brand? The answer is sometimes yes, most of the time no. And in fact, one of the reasons that one of the lectures we have is from one of the most brilliant people at Ogilvy and Mathers, Chris Wall, as a guest lecturer, is because I find these issues of branding and brand positioning and marketing fascinating. And I find them fascinating. Remember, I'm a technologist, I'm an engineer, I don't know whatever the hell I am. I am not a consultant, I don't have an MBA. So when I say fascinating, I mean it from what are the limits of what you can do in dealing with complex systems, complex markets, complex organizations. And here is really what you have to decide. So let's say you're going to spend $500 million to reposition your brand. And by the way, that's often what it takes. Remember, that's $500 million you could have used someplace else. So, I mean, that's a lot of money. It's one thing to take a risk with $10 million. You know, the financial community may not even be able to count $10 million. But when you go to $500 million, that's material money. And so you have to be much more careful with that. But branding is very difficult to evolve, but we'll talk about it November 1st with Chris Wall. It's something you need to think very hard about. And when I say you, and again, I've been on this point since we started, I don't mean, well, the engineers stay in the lab and branding is marketing. As you know, I don't believe that. I mean, of course, you need MBAs, you need that. But when we talk about especially sophisticated, complex systems, markets, organizations, I think it's very important that the same people who have the overall vision and have the feeling be very involved in the markets and the marketing and the organizational aspects. And then they collaborate with the other professional business people because they bring a totally different sensibility to these problems than the people who don't quite have the same feeling about the technology. And that's why you need a team to these complex things. Yes, please.
Dell has always been thinking about like a direct to business. Consumer tastes have changed. Growth has been more in consumer markets in Asia Pacific, where maybe people want to see and touch, and just the change in where the demand is has forced them to develop organizational capabilities where they're not as good.
Forced them to try to develop.
Yes.
No. I'm only saying it that way because, getting back to Michael Jordan, whom I have infinite respect for, I don't know if he had in mind that he would end up playing for the White Sox in Major League. I don't know, or he just, you know, wanted to pay homage to his father, who loved baseball, and was happy to do that. But just because you try doesn't mean you'll be able to. I think Dell was brilliant in the way they did the logistics systems for the distribution of PCs. Brilliant. And again, this is all stuff we'll keep talking through the class. They then honed in the whole company to do that infinitely well. And as long as the direct model worked, they killed everybody else. Only 5 years ago, If you saw the profit margins and the turnover, the asset turnover, they were incredible. What happened is that the market changed, which is what a disruptive innovation is. And the market change is that most people want to buy not desktops, which are commodities, and most people don't give it to this chair. I don't care about this chair, but it's a chair versus your laptop that all of a sudden, that's a personal icon. That's like our, Blackberries and things like that. It's a very intimate personal aspect. And the laptops, as you all know, you need to touch and feel, again, to their credit, Apple has done a brilliant job with that, with the Apple stores, but brilliant. And Dell got caught flat-footed. And yes, they can keep selling the commodity stuff, but of course, more and more the margins are not in the commodity, but in the laptops. And I think that's what happened. And now the question is, now they started a relationship with Walmart. I have no idea how well it will work out. I honestly have no idea whether Walmart will work out or not. I can tell you, and this gets back to the IBM thing, if you say, well, whenever IBM talked about channels like Walmart and so on, it's like people in IBM, you may as well be talking about Mars. Actually, we'd be better at Mars than the channels like Walmart, because of the people who think about Mars and stuff like that. Because as opposed to companies like Sony and Matsushita and so on, who have people who are extremely good at thinking about channels like Walmart, Colgate, Palmolive. And channels are huge, and we'll talk about it just in a second. That's a huge part of taking a product. Well, if you don't have channels to market, you may as well not build anything, because you're not going to get it to market. I mean, you can do that for fun in the marketplace as a research lab. So I think Dell, the question is, can they change? But we'll see. They are, by the way, they might be able to reinvent themselves. Remember, Michael Dell is brilliant. Steve Jobs came back to Apple, and all of a sudden Apple took off. So Dell, because of Michael Dell, might be able to reinvent itself, but the jury's not back yet. I just don't know whether they'll be able to do that. Okay, so let's start with organizational capabilities, and in the paper by Christensen and Michael Rayner, I think one phrase that I think capture a lot of what we've been talking about is this point that, managers assume that if they have really good people in their organization, then the organization in which they work can do anything. They'll be well matched to any problems. And in an understatement kind of phrase, they say often that is not the case. So organizations have limits in what they are able to do. Now, why is that? Why do organizations have limits? Well, I like very much the way Christensen and Rayner framed this question of organizational capabilities. How do you think about it? And they framed it by saying, think of an organization as having three major types of components. Resources, people and stuff like that. Processes. And values. And by values, he didn't mean do you steal, do you pay homage to diversity. He didn't mean that. I mean, those are critical, but those are really critical, especially in a globally integrated world, but that's not what we're talking about. He meant values like, what is this company all about at its essence? So you think of the organization like that. Now, let's discuss before we go to the next stuff is, so which of those parts are easier to change, are easier to apply to some new project?
The resources, yeah.
And why is that? Why would you say that's the case?
Changing behavior of people is more difficult, and processes and values involve them. Changing just a physical object is not very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Even changing individual employees, replacing them with new employees.
That's right. Easy enough. No, that's right. So, on some level, if the people you have now don't quite have the skills, maybe you have them elsewhere in the organization and you bring them over, or you go hire them. So you can do that, and as long as the people you bring are good people, now they are your new employees. And somebody say, well, but you need a new building in London or Bangalore or whatever, so you get a goddamn new building in London or Bangalore. So resources are the easiest to change. Now, why are processes harder? Why would you expect processes? And, you know, processes, think about it, this is the way we do things. You know, that's a, you know, and every company needs to have, this is the way we do things, because otherwise, every time you do something, it's like, oh my God, what do I do now? And at that point, it's too inefficient. So why are processes harder to change? Please.
So it's like, I see it as being personal habits. It takes a long time for processes to become established, becomes incorporated into the company. And just like personal habits, it's hard to break up from them.
That's right.
To realize it and then break up.
Yeah. And of course, in a company, they are more than personal, they are organizational habits. So it's the way things get done around here.
Processes are usually formed after many years of trying and testing, and so they realize that this is the way it works, or they have decided to just have a protocol this way.
Yeah.
If somebody starts protesting against that or goes against that, then that's just going against all the learning they've had over the past many years.
Yeah, that's a very good point, that processes are almost a major part of organizational learning, whereas, I don't know, knowing how to build an iPad, if you know how to build computers, that's a little bit different. Now, having a set of processes for bringing things to market, doing a lot of marketing, style a little harder. By the way, it's a fascinating question. Well, let's talk about values and then we'll talk about some examples. But notice that in all these discussions, when we talk about the word, it feels often very academic. The second we get into examples and what's going on out there, it all comes to life. Because you're almost watching a sports game. You're watching companies screw up, companies do well, companies try. The whole thing comes to life when you see the real examples. And of course, people like Christensen and Rayner and others are very good at abstracting. So what the hell is going on? Now, how about values? What is the key importance of values in an organization? Any comments? Please.
Well, every day, like every employee needs to make a role position.
Yeah, perfect.
And it's basically all tied to the values of the positions.
Perfect. That, you know, especially if you have I mean, if you're running a restaurant and everybody's here, of course you need values, but everybody's in the same place, so it's a little bit easier to share it. But if you are especially in an organization with people distributed around a country, let alone distributed around the world, people need to have a format. How do you behave? You know, how does an employee of this company behave when a customer wants something? God, do I say yes or no? I have no idea. Let me get back to headquarters. Customer is pissed. It's taking you forever. Somebody else comes back and gives them an answer in 10 minutes. They win the business. So values are the things you need to know what is okay and what is not okay. I often think of values in a company as you have to have a pretty good idea what will you get fired for. And what if somebody doesn't like it, you ask forgiveness and go on. And every company will have a different list, and those values are never posted. You cannot go someplace and they'll post the values, you know, no sexual harassment. I don't know if that's a value. But sort of these subtle points, you know. I was just talking, I was at a dinner with some people from IBM on Tuesday, and this executive, Maria Zua, had gone to Peru because IBM Peru was celebrating the 75th anniversary of IBM Peru, and Maria is Cuban, I am, she speaks Spanish well, so she went there. And as she was driving to sort of the event, they had a 7.2 earthquake in Lima. And all of a sudden, here is Maria, who went to do this celebration, and now trying to say, what the hell do we do? Do we cancel this stuff? What do I do? And she, just on this spot, said, you know, I'm sure she thought a little bit about it, said, you know, we have to cancel this. Let me immediately put up money to put up a website so that, you know, Peru can get access. You know, several hundred people died, so it was a serious earthquake. Several hundred, you know, put up a website, help in any way you can, organize for the client. Now, if some financial person someplace said, Maria, you didn't get approval for spending money to put up this website, she would just smack that person and get rid of that, because you know you don't do that. You know, even if it's wrong, let's even assume she shouldn't have done quite that. If somebody made a case about it, it's like they're questioning values. They're not questioning something else, they're questioning values. So that's why things like values are so important, because it's how you want your employees to behave when nobody else is around. And you know, that. So it's a very big part of every company. And I think this is a good way to think about it. And then when you start looking at resources, processes, and values, as we have been discussing, it's clear that they have very different time frames. So the time frames for resources are extremely important in early stages. And if you're starting a new business, an entrepreneur, well, you don't have a lot of time to worry about, okay, what are the values of this company? Let's hire McKinsey to get them. If you do that, you disappear very quickly. So you have to get something out the door quickly. And you probably don't even have processes when you start, because to have processes, you need to have process for something. if you're a new company, you know, you don't have enough employees. You're just almost learning. You're playing it by ear. However, and this is my feeling, and especially in today's world, the most critical thing you need is talent. You really need to make sure you have the right talented people. Please.
Question on the value part.
Yes, please.
And maybe I would like to differentiate between perhaps two sets of values.
Please.
Most companies, including IBM and HP, have published their set of values.
Yeah. I'm not talking about those.
Okay, and those have very little relevance to, because they're so broad and so general.
That's right. They're very important.
Right.
But those are the really long term.
Right.
That's not what I'm talking
about. Right, so we're not talking about that. The values that you're talking about are probably more on the lines of company culture.
Yes, but that's a very good point.
But that culture can actually vary from one business unit to another, from one geographic location to another. And I don't know what I mean, but some of the companies that I've worked at, it was very different from, you know, across business units.
Well, you have to be careful. I realize that, but that's dangerous. By the way, it's dangerous in a way. I'm not talking from having seen the train wrecks happen. So I've seen this at least twice. And in fact, soon you can talk about one of them. I don't know if you saw it. IBM got into horrible trouble in Korea with a corruption case. Were you there at the time, Sunyu?
I think it got resolved, but I think it was during my time. Yeah.
And IBM had a previous one in Argentina. Now, in some companies, somebody can say, well, you know, we're in Argentina, for heaven's sake. You know, this is the way you do business in Argentina. We don't even call it corruption. And they can think that way. Say, you know, that's you bastards in the U.S. and the U.K. And you have the Magna Carta forever in the U.K. But, you know, we're in Argentina or Bolivia or, you know, it's a little different. IBM, like, lost huge amount in Korea because the Korean government had to react when this exploded, and it could even be that something that they would have tolerated from a local Korean company, they could never tolerate from a multinational, from a global company. And of course the press had a field day with that. IBM had to fire the whole senior team. It couldn't do business. It lost a tremendous amount. Similarly in Argentina before. So that's an example. And now we're talking about cult. You know, I think this is an example of these values here. You know, now there are other values that could be very different. So you have to be very careful as to which are the ones that you don't have a choice but to do, and which are the ones that you allow flexibility among countries. You have to be really careful. You know, take discrimination against women. You know, there could be a lot of countries where, well, women cannot come to this meeting. Is that tolerable or not? Well, now you have to do what we call in physics a Gedanken experiment. I don't know if you know. Gedanken experiment means a thought experiment, which means, okay, let's think this situation. So how would you feel if you read in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, you know, IBM Japan is very comfortable not having women in the executive ranks? And I don't mean you read that in Japan, you read that in the New York Times or Wall Street Journal. The answer is that would be disastrous because of the values around the world. So you cannot do that. but there are other things you can do. So these are very important things, and these kinds of quote-unquote soft decisions, and they are soft in the sense of, like, it's not like you add three numbers and you get the answer, are usually the ones that, if you screw them up, you'll find yourself in page one of newspapers under an incredible crisis. So that's why you have to be so careful with them. You know, and then there are the more cosmic values, which we all have, and those are very important to have. But usually, you know, IBM values are, but you know, servicing clients, innovation, and being trust and everything we do, we think those still, it's like if you read the US Constitution, boy, there are all these values, but remember we had slaves for many years under that US Constitution, and women couldn't vote until the 1920s, I think. Women got the vote under the same constitution. So at those high levels, you can hide a huge number of sins. That's why they have to be reinterpreted. So resources are most important in the short term. But of course, what then begins to happen is, as the company starts growing, you know, all of a sudden, it's not enough to be out of control. You know, customer service, manufacturing, HR, and that's where processes begin to come in. Because as you're growing, you start needing to start putting in processes to stay in control. You just don't have a choice. And then, especially as you can keep growing and become distributed, and you know, headquarters move farther and farther away, then you need a set of company culture and so on to guide people in what to make decisions. So far, so good. Wonderful stuff. But the beauty of discussions about complex organizations is the same thing that is wonderful can kill you. And what I find so interesting here is the point that Christensen and Rayner say, that often what happens is that because a company has become so good at having solid processes and extremely good company culture, if they need to go move to do something else, those same strengths will be a huge impediment to go do the next thing. And a small company that does not have this value, or a new company, can all of a sudden start adapting its processes and its company culture to the new environment. And let me give you an example. So somebody can say, well, you know, we have these values for these complex systems, you know, jet engines or mainframe computers or whatever, so that we test the hell out of them before they go to market. But now, what if you are in an area where you're selling products that are not quite as mission critical, let's say more office systems? But, you know, they have to work, but there's a difference between an office system and a jet engine. And if you have this entrenched company value and treat the office system like the jet engine, well, what happens then?
It's late to market.
You're way late to market. You'll get killed. And another company that doesn't know jet engines from a hole in the wall will just do their office systems, do them very quickly, get to market to a more what people call good enough technology, and just run with the marketplace. So it's this major part of all organizational dilemmas that you need to be very good here, and what made you very good is you started with something disruptive, then as it got more and more accepted, you started then incrementally making it better. That's how you got processes. Processes are usually incremental kinds of innovations, and of course company value is long term. But eventually then some other disruptive things come along, and now you will have a lot of trouble reacting to these new cases. And that is a real dilemma. It's a real issue for organizations.
Question.
Please.
On the previous slide, I was curious about the statement in there. The comment there about their value can embrace small markets and cost structures can accommodate low margins.
Right.
This would not be true for a typical venture-based technology startup. Would it be?
Well, I don't know. A number of you, I'm sure, know a lot about ventures. What do you all? I mean, it's a very good question. I would say it depends how much money, what stage of the venture you are in, and how much money that you're asking your investors to give you. That's what I would expect. But any comments? Any of you who've especially been in the venture world? The question was whether, let me sort of rephrase the question, tell me if I'm doing it well. So if you are a more established company and you're trying to decide whether to go after a market, usually the bar for what markets you go after is high. Otherwise, it's not worth your going after, and the kinds of profit margins you expect to get, revenues and margins, are also high. Otherwise, it's not worth it. So you will look at lots of new things and decide they are under the bar for you to pursue. As opposed to a new company for whom this is the way they get going, is that these are decent margins for them. And remember, they are not a $10 billion company. They are a $0 company, so almost, $10 million in revenue is not bad. And they are willing to start with lower margins. And your question was, will the VC world accept that new businesses will start in markets that are relatively small?
That's actually my comment was that for technology and their technology, for technology companies that are backed by VC, they would not back a company that is going after a small market and has a big market.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted you all to comment. Yes, please.
It sounds like the bar is less about profit margin than it is just about risk and return on investment, expected return on investment. Mm-hmm. I mean, the cost of capital for large corporations is much less than it is for a startup. I mean, investors for startups expect 300% returns in their investment, whereas stockholders expect much smaller, maybe 10% mm-hmm. return on investment. So it seems to be much more about
So you're saying
is it worthwhile? Is the size of the market worthwhile to dedicate people to go after it, and then if it is worthwhile, then what's the probability of having a positive return on investment?
Yeah, but I thought what you were going after is that a VC, let's assume there is a potential $1 billion in revenue, but the risk factor is high. Yeah. A VC could invest in that. Because if you hit the billion, their return will be very high, whereas an established business, the risk may be too high. What's that? I don't
right.
I
right. So it's you both have a high expectation of return. It's just the amount of risk that you're willing to take on to get that return.
That's a very good point, and a lot of it has to do with this risk. Yes, please.
I was just going to say, I think a good example might be the services, software as a service in the CRM market.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly.
You mean like Salesforce?
I'm assuming that they were venture-backed. I don't know exactly. But
Salesforce, I'm assuming.
Much lower margins by going for small office customers, and Oracle and SAP were ready to ignore that market.
In fact, this story happens constantly, but I should have said it differently, and I think you corrected me that, you both did, that the VCs want a market that is potentially very large, but they are willing to accept a higher risk of that happening than an established company. Would you accept that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I stand corrected. That's a much better way of putting it. You had a comment?
I was just going to say that in my new enterprises class, there was...
In your what class?
In new enterprises class at Sloan. These two entrepreneurs, recent entrepreneurs, they came in and they talked about what they went through when they were looking for VC funding.
Yes.
And they said that having VC on board changes their future it upsides down the whole thing. So what happens is, before VC, they have a high likelihood of becoming a medium level success, and a VC is not accepting of that. He usually goes for a much higher return, and so he's willing to take a lot more risk, mm-hmm. and he's willing to have no success at all.
I understand.
So it's the same point.
It's risk. You all, excellent point. Yes.
In reading Richardson's and stuff, it's more about the focus on revenue and continuing to drive the business toward all the resources in the business towards revenue or the revenue generation. Taking the risk of new.
I agree totally also. Yeah.
And in The Dilemma, his first book, he says almost categorically, you have to step outside that.
That's right. Well, and that's exactly what...
He softened it a lot
on the second book.
Solution.
Yeah.
I know we heard last week that he had to form almost a guerrilla organization.
Yes.
IBM to get into the internet vision form. And if you look at other examples, like Boca was formed to do the PC business, mm-hmm. to be outside of
That's perfect. So let's talk about that. So how does an organization handle this? And let me start with get a separate team that's dedicated to the new initiative, because if you have a current team, people doing mainframes or people doing whatever, and you say, by the way, I also need you to do this other stuff, and this is an incremental business, and this is a high-risk business, at that point it's too difficult. And usually, for example, what is very difficult, something I have observed like crazy in IBM and other businesses, people running line operations, I cannot tell you how brutal the quarter is. I cannot begin to tell you. I don't know if you've all worked out there. I don't know how many of you have worked in public companies and seen how critical it is to meet analyst expectations for the quarter. And if somebody said, Irving, screw them, you can say that. And then when the stock tanks because you didn't meet expectations, the board has to fire you. So you'll say that on your way out. I'm being very serious. I mean, a lot of people question, God, is this a good way to run a railroad? But We're not in a course here to modify the world's financial systems. That would be a different course. So you need to focus very hard on your line operations, and you also need to worry about the future and go after new opportunities, especially the ones that are based on disruptive innovation. And what we learned is that the only way to do them, that's what Jim Catholic talked about, is to form separate organizations, and that's what they do. And in fact, with the internet division, at the time that I was asked to organize the internet division in December of 95, I was running IBM's Unix business. It was called the RS6000 business. In the Unix business, the RS6000 is like a multi-billion dollar business. Manufacturing and all that stuff. And Lou Gerstner talked to me and said, I want you to go do this. I said, can't do it. I haven't been doing this for so long. And he said, oh, we'll put somebody else to do that. I need you to do this. And what has been our experience is not only do you have a separate group, but if you are serious about it, you also need to almost overstaff it. But by overstaff it, I mean put a very senior executive that people say, well, but Irving had, I don't know, 4,000 people working for him and billions in revenue. Here he has, you know, John Patrick and a few other people, and since we don't even know what an internet business is, he has zero revenue. So is that a demotion, or are you punishing him? Is that a penalty box? And the answer is that the only way to make sure that you put dedicated focus on something new is put somebody who is senior, because by being senior, what it usually means is you have access, you know the people. That being senior, remember, in any organization, what counts is not the hierarchy. What counts is, do you know people and do they respect you? That's all that counts. And being senior usually means you know people, and you have built up your equivalent of your eBay
reputation.
Yeah, you have built up your eBay reputation. And that also signals to the organization and to the outside, but that boy Lou is not bullshitting here. He's really he's serious about this. And you know, we've done this repeatedly with this when we did on Linux and other things. So that's one approach, is start building up these new internal capabilities, but put it in a separate organization. And now something very interesting, and I'll get to the next two, is that, I don't know if this is always true, but it's been true in most of the organizations like this I've been involved. If it's an initiative like the internet or open source software, that at some level, it's not a separate business. It's only a separate business because of these artificial things we're talking about. That at the beginning, it's this little tree and you don't even know where the hell it's going. But eventually, the internet is part of everything, and eventually Linux and open source is part of everything. When you start this, everybody needs to know that success means that you go out of business after a while. Because success means that the rest of the organization has so absorbed this disruptive technology that now you are more of a pain to them. They view you more as an overlay staff than a help. And, you know, once that happens, you know, you stay a little longer, but you don't want to overstay your welcome. And it's a very important thing. You do this, but then everybody knows over time it has to be integrated back in. So it's only a temporary thing. Now, another approach that people do is to have spin-out organizations. Do you have any examples of good spin-outs that you've seen? Please.
Freescale from Motorola is...
That's right. That's an excellent point. Freescale from Motorola.
So they turned out a chip design part of how
yes.
Motorola just focuses on the consumer market and large-scale.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And yes, please.
At one point, Lucent was a great spin-off from AT&T.
From AT&T. This is after the AT&T broke apart, you mean? Would you consider that? Or
yeah, after.
Yeah. Any other?
Well, Avaya from Lucent.
Avaya, yeah. Now, where is Avaya? I mean, Lucent, as we know, the main part of Lucent is part of Alcatel, correct? Is Avaya still a viable company?
It's actually owned by private equity now. I think Silverlake Partners.
They are, yeah. HP used to have Scientific Instruments. Am I not correct?
Agilent,
and that got spun out.
HP Labs.
Xerox Labs.
Is it HP Labs?
I don't think so, but I don't know. Yeah, no, it could be. You may be totally. I know for sure Xerox PARC is in that example, and I think the Sarnoff Labs, and even SRI. There's an SRI in California.
So, in countries like India and where family-owned businesses are there, they spin off a lot of times. Like Tata's have a consulting service that eventually became a huge company, and mm-hmm. it's probably the biggest revenue source.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes.
They have conglomerates, so they keep spinning.
They keep spinning. Sung Yu?
I just wanted to mention that Zoom Park is also a good example that failed all these spin-offs. So they invented all these great technologies.
GUIs, yes.
And internet, and all these great technologies, and actually they failed spin out these organizations. And sometimes what happens is these organizations, like Xerox PARC, if they don't nurture these innovative people, and they don't really separate out these people, and then really push them to have business out of it, then you would lose a lot of chances for making new disruptive technologies.
Yeah, no, it's an excellent point. I wonder if, as I'm now thinking aloud with all of you, if a difference between setting up this new internal capability, like in IBM we call it emerging business opportunity, difference between that and a spin-out may have to do whether your intent is to reintegrate it back in later. And if you intend to reintegrate it back in, be very careful with the spin-out. then you're neither fish nor fowl. Because the spin-out, their financials and everything else are very different. When you try to reintegrate it back in, they'll scream. Whereas, is it fair to say all the examples you gave are companies that you really were spinning out, that you were happy to sell them to somebody else? Does that make sense, that you need to make that decision? Is it temporary or is it... Yes, please.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. I was thinking about a lot of the semiconductor arms of conglomerates were spun off because companies didn't want the ups and downs of the semiconductor industry showing up on their balance sheet. and wanted a more predictable.
Right. But for example, Motorola never expects to reintegrate Freescale.
Yes.
In fact, they
just wanted it to be separate and have two different balance sheets.
What private equity took? Was it Carlyle or?
Freescale,
yeah. I agree that there was a private equity, I don't know which one.
Yeah. The other interesting thing that you mentioned on how I get this emerging business opportunities is, for example, how GM did Saturn there.
Yes.
They said, you want to go after the.
Yeah, Saturn is another example of an EBO kind of thing.
But kept it within the company and just gave.
Now, let me ask you, how about Lexus? Think of
Scion too.
I'm sorry?
Scion.
Now, I think in Canada, Lexus and Toyota have the same dealerships. I don't think, as you know, in the US, Lexus has totally different dealership, but I don't believe that's the case in all countries.
No, but that's not because of coping with disruptive innovation. That's just branding.
No, I understand. So, but what I'm saying is, to some extent, the model Toyota used with Lexus feels more like Category 1 than Category 2. In other words, Toyota has never let go of Lexus. Am I not correct?
Yes.
So so I agree totally. It's now a branding in different countries. But my expectation is, and I don't know anything about this, Toyota said, let's create a really high-end brand. But they couldn't do that. You know, Camry, they didn't want to screw up Camry. And if all of a sudden they say, well, let's make Camry the high-end brand, then, wait a second, Camry's the most successful high-volume brand in the world. And so they set it up as a totally separate thing in the U.S. And so it's a very good example of saying something more differently. It's a very different way. So the both models work. And then acquisitions is very interesting. I have to tell you, the whole view of acquisitions, let me give you my personal view again. When I say a personal view, what I mean is the view based on my experiences. That's what I mean by a personal view, as opposed to what I read in a book. For a long time in IBM, we viewed having to make an acquisition as failure. Because the view was, well, shit. If this is good, we should have done it. And the fact that we didn't do it and we had to go acquire it is a statement of failure. I'm being totally serious. That was the view, and I bet you it must be a view in a lot of companies. I mean, can you imagine companies having that view? Other companies, Cisco, I think, has done a magnificent job becoming an acquisition machine. It's almost like their R&D is acquisition-based. No, I'm being very serious. They've decided, and this is a superb model, that the free market is a better research lab than anything they could set up in-house. So let the free market try things out and so on. And then when the free market signals that something is good, and the way the free market signals is, here is a company with a good product and a high stock value, and they need that product, now we'll buy them. You say, well, but if they had started it from the beginning, they would have saved the money of that acquisition. Yeah, but you're assuming that they would have been able to get that to be successful. And that's a huge assumption. And in fact, based on all of our discussions, that may be a delusional assumption for most new technologies. Please.
Another company that has been an acquisition bandit is Oracle.
Oracle, yes.
Starting with PeopleSoft.
I agree. Well, even before PeopleSoft.
Almost all big companies are big because they acquire. Like Google is from Microsoft.
Yeah. Well, GE is very good. GE, I think they all, this is my experience, and Sung Yu, maybe you want to comment on this. I think that Sung Yu is a real slow person, so that's why when it comes to me. And he's getting a PhD in slow. When I think over the last 10 years, the whole culture of business and acquisitions has changed drastically. And I think it's that we used, in the industrial age, we had the notion of the vertically integrated company, which, as we all know, is the industrial age. But as we've become more, whatever the hell we're becoming, knowledge age, information age, whatever, business are disaggregating. And part of the disaggregation is the ability to both sell assets and acquire assets. And your does that make sense to you?
I agree. I think one thing, adding to that, one thing that we haven't mentioned, but I got this idea when we were mentioning about Lexis. Usually, I think we're talking about the innovation and technological changes, but I think it's also related to the user base.
Totally.
Because most of the time, these big users are the ones who are more
perfect
to use the advanced technologies.
In fact, this gets back to process and values, because for the kinds of customer base you're after, your current processes and values, I mean, if you buy a Corolla and you call the dealer and say, come pick up the car for service, I mean, if they're a nice dealer, I don't know what they'll say. Whereas if you buy a Lexus, the dealer will come and pick up your car for service. So those are, and by the way, that's a process. Remember, if you are going to have dealerships that are willing to pick up cars for service, you need a process with how the hell are you going to do that? And that those processes cost money, so you have to know what you're doing. So you?
Innovation is not just about developing things.
Yes.
Also, it's about the interaction between the manufacturer and the user. And
totally.
By solving the customer's problem.
Yeah.
And I think Oracle is a great example of that. When they acquired
PeopleSoft,
they learned, they acquired the experience of these companies working on
exactly.
a specific problem, like customer
relationship. No, exactly.
So they acquire this experience of interacting with users, and that brings back into the companies. So
perfect point. Yes, please.
I've been involved with Oracle for ages, and actually around.
What business are you in?
Software deployment.
Yes.
But I'm actually going out there next week to talk to their management about this very issue. The headache of Oracle is that it's gone into this acquisition mode mostly to get rid of competition, not to acquire.
Well, especially against SAP.
They've acquired Edwards, they've acquired PeopleSoft, they've acquired all their major competitors.
Right.
SAP. So it's a completely different strategy than hiding that technology out there.
Acquiring
is actually costing them more money than.
But now, what's happened with customer sat of the clients they acquire? Are they providing for the JD Edwards and so on? Is the customer sat good?
They're initially continuing to provide support for them. Of course, they can't support that many products for very long before they kind of have to funnel them all down into what they call fusion.
That's right. I know what fusion is. They're web. Yeah,
they're forcing all of their clients to spend money.
Yeah, to evolve to fusion.
And there's a lot of community. There's a lot of Oracle's making a big effort of trying to calm the community.
I understand. I understand. By the way, what's interesting with Cisco, and I think we've learned this in IBM also, Cisco acquires small companies. and they integrate them immediately. So if you say, well, how about the culture of these small companies, Cisco would say, culture, schmulture. The culture is Cisco. Now, you have to make sure then you acquire a company that is small, so it either has no culture or the culture is
similar.
But you're willing to get rid of it. Oracle, I mean, you cannot do that with Siebel, right? Siebel got too big. So do you think Oracle intends to integrate them on the Oracle brand?
They'll all be Oracle.
So they will do that over time. I think you almost always have to do that. In IBM, this is part of the limitations of the company. I cannot tell you how much we screwed up office systems for decades. Finally, we acquired Lotus. Lotus had a big brand, and so we kept Lotus very strongly as a big brand, but eventually, after about 4 or 5 years, we still have Lotus, but now it's very much a unit in software. But what we've learned is most of the acquisitions we make now are small, and the brand disappears. They get integrated, because big acquisitions where you have to support the brand and culture, that can cause you all kinds of problems. So it's something to keep in mind. Somebody else, did you have a point?
Another example of Oracle's acquisition is this company that was started by Mac Daniels, so it's based out of Boston, and they recently, after 5 months back, they bought it for $2 billion.
Uh-huh.
The reasons they buy it for, one, they have a new product. Second, they also want to merge their product to the existing like Fusion.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
They can sell more Oracle databases than that.
Yeah.
So they want to increase the market base of their existing products.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Beautiful.
Please.
One of the interesting things, we talked about the size of the acquisition and the culture and the brand, is Cisco has acquired Scientific Atlanta.
That's right.
That's one of their biggest acquisitions. And they're treating it very differently than
yes.
They're treating all their the smaller acquisitions.
That's a very good
the
point.
The whole supply chain different. It's vertically integrated.
Yes.
The brand is
because
separate.
It's a very. How about the what's the company of inexpensive routers for the home? What am I thinking?
Linksys.
Didn't Cisco acquire Linksys
yeah.
also?
Yeah, that's yeah. Cisco.
Is Linksys integrated or is it?
Linksys, I think, has been integrated in terms of the supply chain and everything else.
Do they still have a Linksys brand?
They just announced that they're getting rid of it.
They're getting rid of it. So Linksys follows the pattern. But Scientific Atlanta is too early. That's what you're saying is, remember, this follows this talk. Scientific Atlanta is in a totally different field from present Oracle's problem. Whereas Linksys, remember, Cisco had home wireless technology. So Linksys was easy to, well, they've never been in the setup business.
Actually, I thought that Linksys would also be kept at an arm's length.
No, but what I'm hearing, and this is totally expected, is that's temporary, that it's becoming integrated, which is what I would expect, that it become totally integrated. So it's the kinds of things you need to do. Now, why don't we take a break? Now, before the break, John Patrick told me he forgot something, so bear with me. I know I'm going to ask some questions that may sound bizarre, and I didn't lose my head, but I will explain it after I get ready. Now, today's September 27. John was here September 20. So is there anybody here that had a birthday within a week of September 20th? You did? When was your birthday?
22nd,
okay. John said that he brought a copy of his book to give away, and he wanted to give it away to the person with the birthday. He didn't know how else to do it. The person with the birthday closest to when he was here last week. And he asked me to then do this for him. So may I give you, stop by and I'll give you a copy of John's book. So why don't we take a 10-minute break and then we come back.
Do you have another one? Mine wasn't 14.
I'm sorry. I was going to ask next. Okay, thank you. Let's move to then two different subjects, which is when you have a disruptive innovation, what market should you go after? And later on we'll talk about what customers you should go after. And they are actually very related, and this is all very nicely written in Now Back to Innovator Solutions, chapters 4, and I believe the next one is 5. Now, something that is very important when you're trying to bring a new product or service to market is to pick your initial target market. Really, really important. Because if you make the assumption that, and remember, there is a sort of an overriding assumption I'm making, that time to market is extremely important with something new. And that, how can I say this, competitive cost is very important with something new. If you say, well, I'm going to go after the whole bloody market, well, you won't get there. It will cost too much, and you will be equally mediocre in everything. And then what happens is a competitor who has a more focused approach will pick you off. And it may be 7 competitors. So this notion of finding where to position your product in what market is extremely critical. From my personal experience, for example, one of the things I've been very involved in IBM was supercomputing, and in particular starting what became our parallel supercomputing business in the early 90s before the internet. And we made a decision. Parallel architectures were pretty new in those days, in the early 90s. But one decision is, okay, so our launch customers will be Cornell Supercomputing Center and Argonne National Lab, which is a DOE lab outside Chicago. And the reason is because if we told people, okay, that's what we need to do, is do something that's good enough for them. Remember, these are national labs, Cornell Supercomputing Center. These people are going to be very forgiving of a lot of stuff. So you can afford to do something that's good enough for them, that when you then want to go to a more commercial customer, like an engineering company to do simulation or a petroleum company to do seismic analysis, they would expect something 1 degree better. So in some sense, this initial product was not very good, but in fact, the way we looked at it, and I think people have worked doing this more and more, is look at this initial one almost as an alpha. And by picking the right customers that not only were happy with your alpha, but in the case of parallel supercomputing, were honored that you considered them as your partners in an alpha. remember, the national labs and so on are very happy to work in helping you develop new products. That became a way to get something out quickly. And I cannot tell you, that's why this is so important, when you are doing products and services, the world before you are in the marketplace is very different from the world once you have clients. Totally different. Because here, you're all speculating. Here, there are real people, real clients. Go talk to them and go talk to people like that. But what's critical, and it's the point that Christensen makes, is that with something new, you have to position it for the right markets. Now, the finding the right market is something very different for a more incremental product. And there's a whole literature on market segmentation in you know, I'm assuming that's a big part of teaching marketing, right? How do you segment market and do all that stuff? And as Christensen points out, when you are doing incremental things, there is a set of things, you know, price points, so you're at this price point, should you go after this price point, how many people, demographics, and so on. The problem of applying the marketing that works so well for incremental innovations to disruptive innovations, I would say in a nutshell, is part of the definition of something disruptive is you have no bloody idea where the markets will be. And you have no bloody idea, because remember, the way you do the market segmentation is you get market data. And you ask people, and they give you information, you get data. Imagine in 94 going around trying to do a market segmentation for e-commerce. You say, I have no idea what you're talking about. And they would probably say, beyond that, you want me to trust my credit card to somebody over a line that's not even a person? You are out of your bloody mind. So when something is brand new, the reason doing all this stuff doesn't work is because the information you're getting is totally noisy. Please.
So didn't people used to buy things on the street before that?
Yes, so catalogs.
So it was not very different from that. It was an absolutely new idea to give your credit card number publicly out there.
I think the phone and the brand of the company on the phone is what made it different. Now, having said that, it should come as no surprise. You know that we're having, as a guest lecturer, Chris McCormick, who is the CEO of L.L. Bean. He will be our guest lecturer October 25. And the reason I invited Chris and he accepted is because in 96, L.L. Bean and Chris in particular, who was not the CEO at the time, were my biggest partners in launching IBM's e-commerce initiative. Now, to your point, L.L. Bean was totally ready to set up an e-commerce site, because to them, an e-commerce site was such a natural extension from their catalog business. But remember, most e-commerce sites, especially in the early days of the internet, were brand new businesses. Think of Amazon. Didn't exist before. Think of, I don't know, buying wine over the web. You know, there were all these things. And at the time, people just could not consider that. So it was a market that did not exist. So One of this is, I think, it's an extremely important point that one of the biggest innovations for your innovative products and services is to find the right markets in which to first bring out your innovation. We were having a discussion before about healthcare delivery over the internet, and we were talking about, well, is it for people where, you know, they don't want to, they are, let's say, in Boston, but it's a pain in the ass to go to Mass General or wherever they can go, so they like to do that, versus being in a small village in Vermont or being in a small village in India where you are hours away from healthcare. And there's no question that the initial markets you pick are going to determine the kind of product and service you bring out. Even though at some level it's all similar, especially at the beginning, you will do things for one segment that the other segment could care less about, and vice versa. And picking the right one, and remember, this is, think of this, I love this term, the foothold, because you are going after everything, but you need a foothold before you can grow from that foothold, and picking the right one is extremely important, and it's going to totally impact your where you go. Now, please.
I mean, can you talk about the sort of some of the specifics of that supercomputing example? I mean, were you like giving them the supercomputer in order to build your?
Were we giving them?
Yeah,
no,
they were paying
them
for it. And I mean, were the things you were doing to meet their needs different from what you did when you launched to Windu?
Well, they were earlier, so that's why I position it as alpha. Mm-hmm. Because let's take a seismic company, you know, that's using supercomputers for seismic analysis or engineering simulation. Programming parallel architectures is really a pain. The tools are not very good. In fact, they're still not very good. At places like a national lab or a university, there are enough people that are comfortable doing this detailed parallel programming if they can get in return much more improvement for their application. So they are willing to put up with the pain of this detailed programming if the payoff is big enough, which is you get 10 times the performance for your problems by investing in that. The, you know, research communities, universities are willing to do that. If you are a seismic company, you're looking for oil, so you want more an application package that does that. So to get to market for those customers, you have to have worked with the key vendors that they use for their application, and have ported their applications, optimized them. All that takes time. And especially, remember, it's like the first machines went from the loading dock to those clients. So for the application vendors, they haven't even had machines to test. So that's why that takes longer to get that. But our intent at that time was all along to expand it. You know, right now the market is everything, but it's this point of a foothold. We picked the people who were tolerant enough of the quality of what we were able to deliver early, and then we grew from there. And that's why the notion of a foothold is very important. But if you pick the wrong foothold, you know, a customer that you deliver the machine and they say, okay, great, Irving, so when is the software and the tools showing up? is it all? Well, 12 months, well, if you got the machine out of here, or don't send me a bill for 12 months of something, I don't know, but they'll be really upset. So you need to find the people for whom what you are able to deliver at this point is fine compared to other people. Now, the reason this is such a problem often to establish companies, as they say here, is that in order to be able to focus and get a foothold, part of it is that, let's say, you do all this publicity, you say all this stuff, and then people come and say, I'm not ready for you yet. And, you know, people don't like to say that. If you have an installed base, you know, you want to go after everything. So often when you're a large company and get part of the discussion of go after large markets, serve your whole customer base, saying no, saying we're not going to do this, it's a huge fear. And so you'll go ahead and do it, and often with disastrous consequences. I mean, we, just to give you an example, in 95, a commercial customer bought one of our parallel supercomputers to do a scalable database for SAP. If you know anything, ERP applications usually have a shared database, and it's shared, then you have the front end is the applications, and they are more scalable, and then you have the presentation services. The problem is sharing data over a parallel architecture is really difficult. And in fact, to this day, it doesn't work. If you want to share data, you should have a good SMP system, which means a shared memory system. Otherwise, it just doesn't work. So we shipped the machine because we didn't have a good SMP, and the client team, well, you know, they are such a great client, we need to do that. And a few months later, we had to eat crow, take the machine back, and help them port to a Sun machine, which, you know, because the customer relation was so important. Now, the good news is because we handled that transition so well, a few years later, we now had very good SMPs, and we won the business. This time, displaced Sun from that company, have grown that a lot. But that's a very good example. We just oversold it. I don't know how else to say that. And we oversold it for this. Well, how can you say no? Well, you can say no because the damn thing doesn't work for them. And you know, if you're a small company, you know, you're more sensitive to what you can do, what your limits are. You don't have all this stuff. Another big issue with focusing initially is the demand to quantify the opportunity, which we talked a little bit about before, that, you know, the financial, the people you're making business cases, well, how big is the market? Now, the reality, this is the reality, is that, let me say something, and I really don't mean it, even if it gets captured on the podcast. You may as well invent the numbers, because there's no data. This is brand new. So you can put together a whole business model, and you can hire consulting companies, pay them gigantic amounts of money, but there's no data. This is it's a market that doesn't exist. So you almost, one should never make up numbers, but the quality of the numbers that you're giving the financial community for your business case is as good as if you had made them up. And it's because of the lack of numbers. And again, I think that when you make a case in the more VC world, there is more of because, as we discussed before, people are more used to risks, then they are more tolerant of a business model that has big risks in it. And you can be more honest, this is what it, well, you have to be more honest because the expert you're talking about at the VC company have been around, and so they know that what you, they know how to validate what you're telling them. I find usually in big companies, the financial communities are totally geared to incremental extensions of existing businesses, and they have no idea how to evaluate the other businesses. And then usually you have great relationship with channels and things like that, and they will straitjacket you. They'll want the product, and you say, well, this is a goddamn parallel machine. You don't have any experience with that. And they will want to do that. So it is one of the issues that puts the companies in a straitjacket. Another extremely important point is you pick new markets, but then you want to pick customers that will want your products and that you can have for yourself. And selecting customers here is extremely difficult and very, very important. In the case of parallel architectures in supercomputers, the reason the research labs wanted it is because they were able, that there was a big national initiative for parallel supercomputing, and they could get funding from Washington to acquire parallel machines and work hard to solve what people call grand challenge problems, that is problems, think of genomics analysis or things like that, that the present machines couldn't possibly address. So they were pushing the envelope anyway, and the only way they could even begin to address the computing capacities they needed was to get parallel architectures. But remember, that was a brand new market. How many people want genomics analysis? Well, nobody has any idea what genomics analysis is. So that's a research problem. So working with the people who had the need in the research community was a good entree, and eventually one was able to back it up. But trying to go after the existing customer base with the new products, when they, as I said, the first time they ask you, well, how many packages that I use today, Nastran for structural analysis, PanCrash for crash simulation, these are all engineering packages, do you have? I said, I'm sorry, I don't have any of them. Why are you here? When you get them, come back, and of course, we did. But first, we had to work in getting them. And Christensen and Rayner have a very important point, which is the ideal new customers to get are people who could not have gotten what you offer before you showed up. So you're competing with no one. You're giving them a brand new thing. Now let's talk about some examples of a product or a service that when it showed up was just brand new, so it had the market to itself. Any comments from you all that has this sort of non-consumption quality? Please.
Segway,
yes. Segway is like that. Well, Segway, I don't think we can claim success yet.
Yeah.
So Segway, what we don't know is whether it will remain a non-consumption. We don't know that yet, but I agree totally. Segway is in that category. By the way, what I'm expecting will happen is, I don't know if Segway is the one that will make it, but maybe somebody will figure out a personal mobility thing like Segway that will have the good qualities of Segway and will eliminate whatever is not in the cloud. Please. Perfect. PayPal. PayPal is perfect. Yep. It was brand new. Now, there are competitors to PayPal now, am I correct? Doesn't Google have a...
There were at the time, and then Western Union saw it as a threat, so they created some sort of...
But doesn't Google have a PayPal-like competitor?
Yeah. Checkout or something.
Yeah, Google Checkout.
Yeah, I don't know. Please.
Just tell you the summer about People's Express, which sort of is one of the like Southwest.
Yeah.
The cheap airline.
Yeah. Yeah, that was very good. And notice sort of one of the interesting things that when a brand new company finds a market and a set of customers nobody knew existed, you only have it for a little while. Because first, the big boys will come after you, which, as you know, they did to People Express. And second, other, when we look at the airline industry, others will copy you. And so you only have this for a while, and then you have to keep innovating.
I was thinking about Napster, but maybe yeah. more...
But which version? There were two versions of Napster.
Well, not the more legal one. But maybe BitTorrent, which is now being adapted.
Yeah, it could be. How about iPod? Would you say iPod was a market that... that Apple discovered and that's why it took off? What would you say? When I say iPod, I don't think there is iPod without iTunes. In fact, in my opinion, what makes the iPod successful is how brilliantly Apple integrated iTunes with the... What is the software on the PC called? It's called iTunes, right?
iTunes.
No, it's the iTunes on your PC.
iTunes.
With the music store. Is it also called iTunes?
Yeah.
With the iPad, this, the combination of the three, that feels, do you agree? That's totally new.
Yeah, it was the delivery music from iTunes that really...
That's right. It was and it was this trivial click and up from iTunes that captured that.
Just on the same case of the iPod, there were already existing products out there. In fact, some of them are even better. But I think the way they marketed,
yes.
the way they actually went to the same set of customers, they were not cheaper. The product was not cheaper. In fact, Samsung had similar products, but they were much cheaper. Even then, people actually went more for iPod.
Yeah.
And so the
became a fashion statement that sort of marketed it in a different way.
Yeah.
It was not something to listen to music for, it was something that you really had to own.
But is it fair to say that all the MP3 players before, you had to quote unquote rip off, and I don't mean rip off steal, but you had to by yourself put, don't we call it, rip-off is not, what's the word that means? It is rip, not rip-off, rip. Okay. You have to rip, yeah, that's better. We knew that rip-off didn't sound right. You have to rip the music from the CD yourself, correct?
Yeah.
And some people, my daughter, you know, was a teenager, whatever, they loved it. I'm assuming MIT undergraduates loved it. But would you agree that's a very different market than the iTunes market that developed when the delivery became so easy? Would you all agree?
I think it's different, but it feels more like they took the existing components and they took existing technology,
yes.
and existing marketing methods and existing delivery methods. And what their innovation was just kind of combining.
No, that's true. But I bet you they had in mind a customer set. When they did that, in other words, the fashion statement, perfect. Do you think the MIT undergraduates would have bought it for the fashion statement? I don't think so. I think they went after people that ripping CDs, whatever. That's a pain in the ass. I don't want to do that. But this was totally different. Remember, we know a lot about the technology. They didn't know about the technology. So they made it so easy that I think it was a brand new market.
The user interface stood out.
Yes, yes. But I think it's the same different customer set. Remember, I think that when you pick markets and customers, and this gets back to the points that I keep bringing, you can do that by saying, look, the engineers stay in the lab, build the damn thing, and now you get the marketing people. And that assumes that there isn't a very strong feedback between the market and the product you're building. My contention is, in most of what we're talking about, you, when you pick your market and you decide what things you want to put in your product or service, the two are tightly intertwined. And if not on day one, on day two or three, would you all agree with that? And the more the people who know about the product are sensitized to the market, you know, remember, they know what is easy and what's difficult. Remember, I could have gone in 96 to a customer and the customer said, well, Irving, I want a website, but I hate TCP/IP. Sorry, I don't know how to do that. But what if this customer said, Irving, I want a website, but I like purple? Let me go back to the lab and let me talk to our people. I mean, obviously, we can do purple in 2 seconds. Now, today we know all that, but don't underestimate how much knowledge about your product is critical to know what is a piece of cake to change, what you can change in a week and a half, and what is like asking you to do the internet without TCP/IPs. That may as well ask me to go faster than the speed of light. You cannot do that. So it's a very interesting interplay. Yes, please.
I think one is Apple's very good as a company of engineering experience rather than engineering piece of hardware.
Precisely. Perfect.
Perfect.
I love the way you put it, engineering experience, which in my mind is a market strategy. That starts bringing engineering with market strategy.
There's another thought.
That's a very good way to say it.
As the iPod took off, what was limiting its penetration what was limiting the iPod and penetration in the marketplace was not the attractiveness of the unit, but it was people's grasping the concept of why they needed that unit to buy it.
Yes, yes.
Understand it to buy it. Right.
No, right. But that's the beauty of getting to the marketplace early, because the only way to do what you said was to be in the marketplace and have people love what you have, right? And that's your point. That once it's out there, it almost became viral. Is that the point?
Yeah. Well, if you're introducing a piece of hardware that's better than anyone else's, people already understand what it does. If you introduce a supercomputer that's twice as fast as everyone else's, it's a different dynamic in the marketplace than if you introduce something which is completely foreign to people.
No, I understand.
You have to absorb the whole concept.
No, I understand. I understand totally. How about Netflix? Let's talk about its service. Would you agree that was... You all know what I mean, Netflix? Does it have this quality of... I mean, what was Netflix just, okay, so there is the video stores, Blockbuster especially, and Netflix went after them, but you didn't have to go to Blockbuster. What's your views of that? And then I'll tell you my view of Netflix.
Well, their business model is different than Blockbuster's. Blockbuster only gives you, like, the top few movies that are out.
Exactly. And exactly. And... Do you all know about the long tail? You know what I mean by the long tail? I think, Blockbuster was, by definition, they had to be in the fat part of the long tail, Netflix, you know, was, you can have anything. Now, if you had gone to ask people, well, do you want an internet service that services the long tail? Well, first of all, the article, the long tail, didn't come out after Netflix. In fact, Netflix, I beg you, was one of the reasons for the article in, where was the article published? In, will come to me. One of the internet journals. It was Fred Herring, one of them. Yeah. And nobody knew that once you made it very easy to get Bollywood movies and Chinese movies and Hollywood classics, people would start getting them. Nobody knew that. Turns out people are doing that. That's a very good example of discovering a market that people didn't know. Now, what I don't know, maybe some of you know, is did Netflix know that on day one, or were they competing with Blockbuster, but then when they found out about the long tail, they say, shit, that's the market. So screw Blockbuster, let's go here. Go ahead, make your points, and I think
they also changed the consumption habits. So with Blockbuster, you would have the card, but you don't have to keep going there and get it every week or every month, right? You could just take one now and then another one, say, 5 months down the line. But with the model that they have, you sign up for a monthly package and you keep getting
it. Actually, now that I remember, I remember now what Netflix said was the key thing they were going after, and it wasn't the long tail. Go ahead, please.
So one of the things that people, if you rented something, you have to return on time, otherwise you have to pay.
Perfect. That was it. No, perfect. I remember Netflix initial pitch was fines, and people were really upset at the huge fines they were paying. Am I not correct? And so they got rid of fines through the model of the rental thing. They got rid of fines. And then they probably then discovered the long tail. That's what I would expect. Let me tell you, this is a very interesting story. I've been very involved with the whole virtual world and Second Life stuff. Do you all know what Second Life is?
Yeah.
And Second Life is a massively multiplayer online game, but it's not a game, it's an environment with avatars. You know what an avatar is? Okay, you don't have to know, but you're doing it. And I know the people from Second Life very well, the head of it, and the CTO, Corey Andreshka, and others. And I was talking to them one day, and they said, you know, they started with this Second Life, you know, just create an environment, and it was going nowhere. And then one day they noticed that people that were using Second Life, this is like 01 or 02, were building their own stuff in Second Life. Now, I don't know if you know, what really differentiates Second Life from World of Warcraft or most other massively multiplayer online games is that in Second Life, you can build buildings and all kinds of things yourself, whereas in all the other ones, the vendor pre-builds almost everything for you. That's the biggest difference with Second Life. Do you all know what I'm talking about? But they told me that, you know, their plan had been, you know, we'll create an environment, but we'll put things for the people. But they also said, you know, and we won't make the tools proprietary. But then they woke up one day, and they found out that people were building their own stuff. They say, how can anybody be doing that? Because our tools are so incredibly primitive. And then they found out that people were holding courses in Second Life teaching each other how to use these primitive tools. So all of a sudden, organically, they discover their business model, that what the users of Second Life wanted was that what they loved about it is, unlike everything else, they can build things. And the fact that it was almost impossible to do it for most people, it's gotten much better since. You know, the early adopters taught each other. Remember, there were no manuals, there was no anything. And what Corey and Phil said is their business model changed. They had a board meeting, and all of a sudden they had a totally business model. So, no, but this is very important. A reason to get from the lab to the marketplace very quickly with something new is because that now lets you discover what works in the marketplace, whether it is the long tail in Netflix. And this is very important also. You need your technical people to be very close to the marketplace, because they may see things that are going on that they know, oh, shit, we can do that. That the people who are not technical, just they just don't know. They don't know the difference between having a website with a purple background and having a totally different HTTP stack. Those are very different things. But remember, we take for granted that we understand that, but if somebody doesn't know that you cannot go faster than the speed of light, they may come back to you with that as a requirement. You have to know that that's not a good requirement before you understand that. So it's why in these areas of disruptive innovation and experimentation, it's so important to move quickly. Let me just only spend a few minutes on this topic, because then I want to come back, as I've been doing, with the IBM example of the market innovation. An interesting point, and I'll go very quickly here, and if it doesn't get communicated well, I won't spend a lot of time either. You can read this in one of the chapters. I'm very fond, when I talk about innovation, I like to tell people that the key reason you need to innovate is because otherwise you die. Now you can say, well, that's a very fatalistic view of innovation. Why don't you tell them about the wonderful opportunities? Well, this gets back to the first bullet, which is, if you tell somebody, you know, wonderful opportunities, they'll say, you know, Irving, my business is pretty good, we're doing well, our customers love us. But, you know, when we have a chance, we will consider this opportunity. However, if you tell them there is an asteroid coming straight at your head, and there are three competitors that are already have efforts to take away your customers, then all of a sudden you get their attention. That's the threat. And what's so interesting is Christensen in this chapter, I believe he's 5 or 6, cites studies that have shown that, you know, people just react much, you can get their attention with threats that you can never get them with opportunity. But these are social science statistical studies that indicate that. And these threats just will catch their attention. But now, Christensen is saying, but be very careful, because if you really scare the bejesus out of the company, if you really, really, really scare them and say that we are under threat of having our customers stolen from us, then what they'll say is, my God, we'll do everything to protect our existing customers, and we don't want you to do that, because you really want to, this gets back to the disruptive innovation, let's go find new customers. we'll continue to serve the existing customer. But if you scare people enough, just say, no, we'll protect the new customers. So he advocates a very interesting approach. And I don't know, he says, let me sort of give you the glib side of how I interpret what he said. When you're talking to the resource allocation people, scare the hell out of them. Because you need the money. This gets back to, book one, the innovator's dilemma. You're competing with people that say, don't give this idiot the money, give it to me. And you're saying, this guy will be dead if you don't give me money. So do that. However, you really don't want this guy at all. You just want his money or part of his money. So once you get the money and you now want to set up the organization, you now want to say, no, this is really a wonderful opportunity to go after new markets, so let's set up an independent unit, let's make a... You want to execute in a totally different way from the operational business. So he's saying you have a balance to strike between the threat and having people be able to let you do your thing for a while because you're not ready for all the attention that a threat would give you. Any comments on that?
My comment would be that the people who are responsible for resource allocation are often the same people who are responsible for strategy formulation. It's kind of tough to tell both sides.
Well, so you have to be very sophisticated. It's a very sophisticated... it's an interesting argument. I brought it up because I find it very interesting. I agree it's not easy, but it may be that you just have to play it carefully. That's really
all I would say.
Any other comments? So now let me switch back to IBM and my experiences with the setting up our internet organization. And let me talk about these four factors that we took into account in trying to make decisions about how do we organize our internet business. What do we need to do? Remember, we had already made the decision we need to do that. We set up the internet division. But trust me, when we set it up, when Lou said, let's do an internet division, I said, look, what's an internet division? I said, well, as a general manager, when you figure it out, of course you'll come and tell me. We had no idea. We knew we needed to do something, but we had no idea what it is we needed to do. We also knew whatever we needed to do, this is December of 95, was the most exciting thing since sliced bread. But, you can only say that so many times before somebody comes back and says, how do I make money from that? And how do the customers make money? So you need to translate all this excitement. You need to monetize excitement. Eventually, you have a honeymoon period of a week and a half where you can be all excited. And after that, you better start working on how do you monetize it. So let me go through each of these four points and comment about them. So we have the capabilities and the competences, that is, the organizational capabilities and the competence. Remember the discussion we had at the beginning. Well, the way we framed the internet and it worked was that this was just the evolution of the IT infrastructure. That's the way we framed it. By the way, not everybody was framing it that way. A lot of people said, here is IT, legacy crap, leave it alone. Here is the internet. Obviously, any new business that had no legacy, that's what they should say. And we said, no, the internet is just the evolution of the IT infrastructure. Well, guess what IBM's core business was? IT infrastructure, hardware, software, and services for IT infrastructure. Well, if the goddamn internet is the evolution of the IT infrastructure, we sure as hell need to have the organizational capability to go after it. And if someone said, well, but it's TCP/IP versus SNA. Well, first of all, we had enough people who knew TCP/IP. SNA was dying anyway because TCP/IP was killing it. It's a very sad story of mismanagement on IBM's part. We let SNA,
Same story as Token Ring and Ethernet.
I'm sorry?
The same story as Token Ring and Ethernet.
Yeah, the same story as Token, that's a very good point. So, you know, we have good stories and we have sad stories, like all of us in everything we do. But we framed this and everybody got convinced of this, that, IT infrastructure, then we have to go for it. Now, then there is the question, well, how about your legacy? How about your base? You know, like, you know, here you have this legacy, $1 trillion, you say that. You know, I don't mean $1 trillion of installed base. You said, well, how much hardware, software do customers have that they have acquired from IBM in 96? Since nobody has any idea, assume it's $1 trillion. And now you're going to start this whole new business. Well, here is the beauty of the internet and why the internet was so successful. You could relatively easily internet enable everything. So what do I mean by that? So you know that Federal Express and UPS were letting you track your packages over the internet very early in the game, in 96, correct? Guess what the transaction systems they were using were that had all the information about what your packages were? Did they rewrite them in 2 weeks from their mainframes and mainframe software? It's software called IMS and CICS that was actually developed in the 70s? Of course not. They kept all that software, but the beauty of the internet, what made the web, the internet wouldn't have been the internet without this quality. In other words, it may have been a good network for research communities, but what enabled it to take off was the ease with which you can internet enable everything. But when I say everything, everything, you can internet enable, you know, TCP/IP on every product, you can put every piece of software. So, in other words, having a legacy was a base to now internet enable. So it was actually a very positive thing to do. Now, not every vendor would view it that way because, again, as I say, if you don't have a legacy, then what you should do is go tell people, now that the internet is here, go get rid of the crap these people have been selling you for years and let's do brand new stuff. But most customers were relying on this stuff to run their businesses, so they couldn't get rid of it. And once you internet enable everything, they were very, very happy. In fact, this strategy came out by me and other people observing what Federal Express and UPS did it on their own. They didn't ask us to do it for them. We then discovered it and we said, what a brilliant strategy. Let's make it our strategy. And so we embraced the notion.
Question left. So when the strategy came out, was it the responsibility of the new business unit?
Yes.
To make this happen?
Yes.
Or was it, so did you not face resistance from the other business units that...
No,
the problem
no, no, was? Because, no, no, but here is the beauty. Let's say you are in the mainframe business.
Right.
If I went and say, you know, the internet means mainframes are gone, now they would say, you're an idiot. I said, mainframes are wonderful. We can now internet enable all the mainframes. So when I had now my marketing internet events, guess who I invited to talk about the internet and mainframe? Like the head of the mainframe division in the Stanford at the time was one of my speakers at one of our first meetings in San Jose. You know, in the there was a big internet event because this would only add value to the mainframe. Do you understand my point?
But I was curious about who are the developers from the mainframe group or from your group?
No, a combination.
Okay.
But remember, the nice thing about technical people, really good technical people, is they smell good stuff way before anybody else. And I know I'm being, I may be biased because now I'm talking about the world that I come from, but that really good technical people usually, even if you say, don't do that, we don't want you to do the Internet of Linux, they usually are part of a professional community, they have friends in universities, they hang out in conferences there. So you can tell them whatever you want to, and they'll do. I'm talking about good people. So smart management of good people is to figure out what they are doing and embrace it as your strategy. So the good people were already internet enabling all the products without anybody ever telling them. Like this is a real interesting story, not about the internet. Later on I ran our Linux initiative, and I remember I met in Germany with some executives from SAP, and we were having lunch, and they told me that, 6 months earlier, they had been to IBM's lab in Germany, Birmingham, near Stuttgart. And they had seen that the people in Birmingham on their own had put Linux on the mainframes. And they said, oh my God, they'll be fired. I mean, they were really worried that these people that put Linux on the mainframe would be fired because, you know, the mainframe is so holy, how can you do that? And I told them, no, they became heroes in IBM, that on their own, without anybody telling them what to do, they saw the power of Linux on the mainframe, and they went ahead and did it, and IBM then embraced Linux on the mainframe as a major mainframe strategy. So this is what makes all this so interesting, and we'll keep talking through the course. Headquarters is not the real world. It is not. The only reality is what goes on in labs and what goes on in the marketplace. That's the only reality. People build things, people use things, people invent things. That's why if you're a really smart business, you use headquarters for counting money and I don't know, whatever the hell they do in headquarters. You know, you need headquarters. You need HR policies and you do need to make the quarter. But you really pay tremendous attention. This is, by the way, one of the company values.
For example,
and IBM has that. So, but this is an incredible, because, you know, I bet you there are a lot of businesses that say Irving doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, headquarters with MBAs from Harvard and McKinsey consultants and so on. They say, boy, are you in trouble? Today, maybe that was true in a kinder, gentler time, but in today's world, it's moving too fast. And because it's moving too fast, the labs and, you know, that's where all the action is. So these were two very positive things. Then did it fit with our organization and culture? Well, yes and no. Because IBM moved very slowly. Very, very slowly, and the dot-coms that all of a sudden we were competing with moved like crazy. They moved like crazy. I mean, they often were putting total crap in the marketplace, but you didn't know it was that until they did it. So this was a problem that we really had to change the organization and the culture to be able to to get things to market much, much, much faster. And we develop new things. Now, the people who were more totally in charge of changing the organization is John Patrick. You know, you can imagine John Patrick doing that, whereas the people who have to run the line, they couldn't do this. But to Lou Gerstner's credit, the reason John and I and others could do that is because when we showed up and we want to do alpha work, somebody said, you know, Irving is an idiot. How can we do that? They knew, wait a second, Irving may be an idiot, but Lou Gerstner is not an idiot. And he's the one who empowered these people to do what they are doing. So we'll talk toward the end of the course on organization and culture. Everybody in an organization reads tea leaves, and they know, you know, is it dangerous to hang out with Irving and John Patrick, or is it okay, and in fact the boss likes them? And the signals you send are extremely important, because the senior team, especially CEO and so on, are empowering people to go make change. And people read tea leaves. So we have to change that. And John Patrick talked about alpha works, remember? There were a whole set of things that we had to invent that we did. And now lawyers didn't like alpha works. Again, well, I guess Lou told them to do that. Lou may not know what he's doing, but, you know, he's the chairman, so we better do it. Please.
So if one's in a, you know, position like Lou was in, where you basically have to decide whether to empower someone to be disruptive and change the organization, what do you actually look for in terms of deciding if the person you're empowering is actually
Let me again talk about, you know, Lou knew that I had been very involved with the mainframe business. I have run a lot of things. So he knew that I would only be revolutionary up to a point. So you part of the reason of entrusting senior people is that, again, this gets back to being part of the company values and so on. That, you know, part of what makes you, remember, I'm not talking about seniority with hierarchy, but that understanding is, you know, your limits. And not just your limits, you know how far you can push things before all hell breaks loose. You have to be careful. Also, we had lots of communication. I'll get to that again in the last section. We had constant meetings. I don't know, constant meetings. I saw Lou and the top senior team in IBM once a quarter in the first 2 years, at least once a quarter. And we had a lot more communications than that. So that, you know, if I ever went too far, we can have the discussions and reining in, but that part of this is, see, most businesses could say, you know, this is disruptive crap, it's not making money. Put this young person that is brilliant, but, you know, he screws it up, she screws it up. The problem is you're playing with fire, or you're setting up this person from failure before that person even started. Because if it's somebody too junior, she will be afraid, you know, she will just self-censor far more than they could. Whereas, you know, Jan and I have been there for a while, and we had pretty good batting averages for pretty good jobs. So that's why putting senior people to handle disruptive innovations is so critical. I'm expecting, if you are a VC and somebody comes to you with a new idea, don't you make similar judgments about the management team? You have to, right? So part of the judgments you make is not just is the person smart. I mean, let me assume that for all everybody. I mean, if somebody said, "Well, he's an MIT graduate," well, shit, every MIT graduate is smart. So the qualities you're looking for are not classic smart. You're looking now. I would still call it smart, but is they have tremendously good organizational skills, tremendously good market sense. They are good in dealing with people, and that takes a lot of smarts. Yes, please.
Would you agree if I said that IBM was able to make a lot of money out of their internet strategy because IBM had a huge customer base of mainframes, which were essentially black boxes, and only IBM knew how to connect them to the web? So these companies wanted to get out of the web, and they had to ask IBM to come help them.
Yeah. Well,
and that's how we...
Definitely, I would say yes, but it's not that black and white. Because other companies could also connect. So so we were not the only... Remember, it's open standards, open store.
No, but the mainframe weren't open standards.
So no, but... Right. Yes. I think IBM... what you said is true. I mean, I can... It's not worth... Because you can understand it's a more... Yes, you're absolutely right. That's true. And it wasn't just the mainframes. It was also the software, you know, the transactional software. It was everything that could connect. Anybody had the...
Yeah, I had a question. That example that you gave about one of the engineers running Linux on mainframe, would that kind of behavior be tolerated in the marketing organization? Would that kind of behavior be encouraged in the marketing organization or other parts of the company?
What a very good question. This is a values. We're now, I think that the technical community in IBM has a special role. For example, there is on Monday I'm going, even though I'm only emeritus, but we have a meeting of the IBM Academy of Technology, which is an incredibly respected group by everybody. And the people who put Linux on the mainframes, we knew they were brilliant people. So, I think the short answer is not to the same degree. That there is a respect for technical credentials that is huge. And that's probably part of the company values. There is just this huge respect. Whether for good or bad, I actually think it's good, but it's an arrogant statement to say that that's the world. Now, IBM used to be horrible in marketing. IBM has gotten infinitely better in marketing, much, much better. But still, the technical community has a special place, I would say. Yes, please. Do you agree with that?
I agree, but I'm trying to translate it to other... Like, we talked about Apple and how...
Yeah. Steve Jobs is a pretty good technician.
Well, maybe that's not... Take a company like Coca-Cola. That's really known for marketing.
No, I understand.
Are there other companies where, IBM is the technical...
By the way, I think Microsoft has tremendous respect for their technical people. I mean, starting with Bill Gates, what the hell is he? He prides himself in being chief architect. And I know he says he's retiring. He'll be chief emeritus architect, but I get you, he'll be. Are there other companies?
Do they let their marketing people do the equivalent of putting the links in the mainframe?
I don't know. I honestly, that's a very good question. What do you think? I mean, you've all been around in your companies. What do you see?
I would say less so, because the putting Linux on the mainframe isn't something that's affecting customers when they do that. And usually, like, in a marketing position,
that's
customer
right.
facing. So I think there's a difference between a customer facing role and an issue.
Yeah, that's a very good point. They didn't go to a customer and put Linux on their mainframe.
Right.
They put Linux on a mainframe in IBM's lab in Germany. And later on, we took that to customers. But when we took them to customers, so it's... But, you know, we'll talk in a couple of weeks on leading customer-based innovation, which is Eric von Hippel's book. Eric, by the way, is Sung Yu's thesis sponsor. And Eric has done a lot of research about leading edge customer innovation. In a lot. I really recommend you read the book. And by the way, Eric, this is now Eric's view of the world. His book is on the website, and you can download for nothing, just because he believes in open content. But Fido is a very good person. I would recommend reading Democratizing Innovation, because it addresses exactly, we'll discuss that in class, and Eric very nicely lent me slides, so I have his own slides to talk about his ideas, but he talks about a whole set of companies that do that, and it's the market it's still experimentation, and I don't know whether, we now can get into questions. Is market experimentation done by the marketing people or by technical people who are working in the marketplace? And then, by the way, we have, for example, in the IBM Academy of Technology, an increasing number of the technical people are market-facing. So we now get into what do you mean by a marketing, by somebody in the marketplace, which is an interesting point. So let me now talk about the last point here. Remember, we've talked about three, which is, do we have brand permission to have an internet presence? And the answer was yes and no. As it turns out, and that's why I invited Chris Wall, we spend hundreds of millions in the marketing campaign, because of exactly that point. We didn't have the brand permission, and especially when we started in 95-96, remember, we had just come from this near-death experience, so it's like IBM, an internet company, it's like, give me a bloody break. Netscape, you guys are, I don't know what you are. I didn't even know you were alive. But we had to work extremely hard at the brand formation, but extremely hard. In fact, I would say that the internet organization and me personally, I would say I spend the bulk of my time here in the market strategy and in getting acceptance, because almost everything else, you could almost say other people could also do. This is this you cannot do part-time. So this was probably what we spent the bulk of the time doing, and that's why I got so involved in marketing, because I would say marketing, in market strategy, which Lou Gerstner defined as market strategy means develop a strategy to be successful in the marketplace. And you could say, well, what other strategies should you ever develop other than a strategy to be successful in the marketplace? That's a market strategy, which is not the same as advertising or something like that. So I think, you know, this is a slide from 96. I started using this slide in 96, which I think in my mind was seminal in helping us figure out what our internet strategy was. Remember, this we didn't invent. This is the internet and Java and all the GUIs out there that existed. And that stuff is all the legacy stuff. And where we positioned IBM was, we're the ones who will bring these two together. That's where we positioned ourselves. And in retrospect, it was brilliant positioning because, first of all, well, all the reasons we talked about before, if all of a sudden, I think somebody asked if the reason, you know, the mainframes and so on, all of a sudden, the rest of the company loved us. Remember, we never said, this stuff will replace all this crap. We never said that. That would have been suicidal to have said that. I don't mean just mean suicidal organizational. Remember, this was making zero money. All the money is here. This was a huge sink of money initially. And of course, that money came from the money that was generated up there. So the last thing you want is to devalue your install base. I think, by the way, that's what the old AT&T did wrong. The old AT&T, this was cable and wireless. I don't know if you remember, they acquired Macaw. And they how did they acquire the cable? Mike Armstrong made a number of acquisitions in the old AT&T. And their legacy business was business telecommunication services for business and long distance. They took totally their eye off the ball here. And the problem is they ran out of cash there before these businesses started generating cash. So, you know, you don't want to fall into that goal. Where, yes, you call the right long-term strategy, but unfortunately, you run out of cash before you could get there. I mean, that's not a good idea. So this really is what we ended up doing. Now, we'll come back to this slide next week, but I just wanted, I tried to summarize what I thought was something very important that worked for us, which is this question of balance, that we embrace the disruption, but probably in a very different way than Amazon or eBay or, you know, other companies. I would think I could have probably done a slide like this for Microsoft that would be very similar. And it was a balance. So we leveraged the organizational skills and talent because, after all, this was the IT infrastructure, but we had to make major cultural and organizational changes because there were serious problems like time to market we had to address. We leveraged the legacy. But I skipped over that slide, and I'll talk next week. We had to embrace open standards. You couldn't be an internet company if you did not embrace open standards and totally shift it. We leveraged the brand, but we had to totally reposition it. That's why you had to spend hundreds of millions. You know, all of a sudden, you said, oh, IBM's brand, you guys wore white shirts and blue suits. No, that's 50 years ago. We had to really do massive repositioning. And then we really had to be in tune with the marketplace. I don't know how else to say that. And that was probably the biggest change, that to really be a successful internet company, all of a sudden, it was critical to be out there and accepted as a member of the internet community, which we did. But it's this balance between the legacy and what you are that keeps moving future and the whole new disruption, striking the right balance that I felt was the really, really, really difficult stuff. And that was the part that was why we needed a total organization. Because this is really the market strategy. I mean, that's what we mean by market strategy. And out of this flow products and services and things like that. So, any last questions? I'll see you next Thursday.